Lecture notes 4, which I just put up on the wiki, they're short. I was writing lecture notes 4, and I was going through this complicated business about kinetic theory and expanding spacetimes, and it was too much. So I scrapped it at the last minute. So I'm going to hopefully do something that's more just more understandable in the allotted time, if not quite as it's the key stuff. And you'll remember it when you're lost on a desert island. It'll be good. But the notes themselves were kind of prepared in a rush, so maybe I'll prepare an improved version of the actual notes for next time. Okay. So we want to know, we were finally getting down to discussing how the FRW metric responds, how the scale factor responds as a function of time to the matter content in the space-time. And again, the two basic equations that we had to work with were the... See, why am I starting over here? I'll start over here. The two basic equations we had to work with were the Friedman equation and the continuity equation. Where I remind you that H here, the Hubble expansion rate, if we wrote it in terms of proper time, would be A dot over A. And if we wrote it in terms of conformal time, there's a 1 over... So A dot... Maybe I didn't say this. So we have these two time coordinates we use, t and eta. D dt is denoted by a dot. So dA dt would be a dot in conventional usage, whereas dd eta is denoted by a prime. So dA dt would be a prime. And so it's easy to check that the Hubble expansion rate is either a dot over a or a prime over a squared. Okay, so basically, rather than doing an overly general analysis of this set of equations, we just want to get the basic idea of what the possibilities are in the simplest way possible. So the simplest way possible is when is when p is equal to a constant w times rho. And so for a number of physically important matter components in the universe, this is the way that their pressure and energy density are related, and for different values of w. So we'll see that more in a minute. But so for non-relativistic matter, you have this equation, but with w equals 0. For ultra-relativistic matter, you have this equation with w equals plus 1/3. For vacuum energy density, you have this equation with W equals minus 1. So W equals 0 is non-relativistic matter. W equals 1/3 is a gas of ultra-relativistic matter. And then W equals minus 1 is vacuum, or a cosmological constant. And so maybe I should also make a remark about, so I've been using the terms cosmological constant and vacuum energy interchangeably. And that is because the concepts are more or less interchangeable and difficult to distinguish from one another. So you'll notice that when we derived the Friedman equation originally, that there was an extra, when we originally wrote it down, we derived something like and so now we've plugged in n equals 3, but also the lambda term has mysteriously disappeared from that equation over there. And that is just because from now on I am just going to treat, you know, I can always rewrite this equation as No, that should be plus. Sorry. This should be plus. And what I mean to say is that, what I mean to say here is that I'm going to define a new effective energy density that just incorporates lambda. So this effective energy density is what I had previously called rho plus an additional term, which is something like lambda over it's maybe 2 over I was firmly committed to no longer dealing with the general n case, but is this correct? This is possibly the correct formula, but in any case, when you plug in n equals 3, since I can't do algebra on Blackboard, I believe rho twiddle is this. And so I'll call this rho vacuum energy. And so there's this bit, in other words. And so another way to say this is that one can argue that for example, if you have a scalar field, in the first lecture we wrote down the Lagrangian for a scalar field. And calculated T mu nu for that. Okay, so T mu nu is equal to something. Now, if the scalar field is in its vacuum, so it has some potential, and the scalar field is just uniform everywhere, so any terms that depend on gradient of phi in the stress energy here go away. And all that's left is the constant V evaluated at its minimum. Okay, so in that case the energy density if you calculate the energy density part of this, it looks like let's say under the assumption of homogeneity, if you calculate the energy density, we'll actually get back to all this. So I apologize that I'm doing this a little bit sketchily. I just want to make one point about that there is some physics behind my referring to this bit that I've now incorporated into the stress energy, referring to this as the vacuum energy. And the simplest way to see it is just so the energy density of the scalar field is this when it's homogeneous, and the pressure, as we'll work out in more detail later, but just take my word for it for the moment, is this. If the scalar field is completely homogeneous and independent of time, it's just sitting stuck in the minimum of its potential, that's the so then these terms go away, and that's the configuration that minimizes rho, and V just becomes V min in both cases. So rho is equal to plus V min, P is equal to minus V min in that case. And then this is called the vacuum. This would be for that single scalar field theory, that would be the pressure, the vacuum energy density and the vacuum pressure. And so you know two things about this. One is that rho vac is equal to minus P vac, which is how we said it should be for vacuum energy density here. We wrote W equals minus 1, that they're equal to minus one another. But also, if you take that solution and plug it in here, you know, you find that this is just equal to minus V min times G mu nu in that case. But on the other hand, I'm trying to do better about writing things, you know, consecutively on the board. On the other hand, we could have taken the Einstein equations and pulled this term over to this side, pulled the cosmological constant term over to this side, and then defined this whole thing to be the new effective stress energy tensor incorporating this lambda term. And so the point is that minus lambda g mu nu looks, minus a constant times g mu nu looks exactly like the stress energy from a scalar field that's just pinned in its vacuum, minus v min times times g mu nu, as long as I make the identification, and Einstein's equations is that g mu nu plus lambda little g mu nu is equal to 8 pi g Newton. So as long as I make the identification that 8 pi g Newton times v is equal to lambda, or in other words, v min, i.e. rho vacuum, is equal to lambda over 8 pi g Newton. So that was a confused explanation. I hope that will be explained more clearly in the upcoming lecture, hopefully later this week on dark energy. But so the point is to get across that vacuum energy you can explicitly see for a scalar field, and more generally you can argue that it has to be the case that the vacuum energy density should be a Lorentz invariant. So it has to come in this form. It has to have this form that it's proportional to g mu nu. But on the other hand, the cosmological constant term, once you pull it over to the right-hand side of Einstein's equations, is also just the term that is, by definition, proportional to g mu nu. So those two terms, there's no clear way to distinguish between them. And the simplest thing is to just not worry too much about it. And if there's no physical way to distinguish between them, just declare them to be the same thing. And so that's what we're going to do from now on. So I'm going to suppress the lambda in this equation, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to be considering the case where there is a non-zero cosmological constant lambda. It's just that we will, from now on, call that a component of this energy density, the vacuum energy, with W equals minus 1. Okay, so with that aside, so now this I am going to erase, because first of all, it's really confusing. It'll be less confusing if I erase it. Okay, so back to business, as it were. The case that I want to consider to just get a sense of the possibilities here is W equals constant. And so to proceed with the analysis, if we put W equals constant here, the continuity equation then can be easily integrated. So if I replace P by W rho, this becomes minus 3 A dot over A 1 plus W rho. And so then if I divide both sides by rho and multiply by dt on both sides, I get d rho over rho is equal to minus 3 1 plus W dA over A. But then I integrate both sides to get log rho is equal to minus 3 1 plus W log A plus a constant. But that just says that rho is proportional to A to the minus 3 1 plus W. So rho is equal to rho naught A over A naught minus 3 1 plus W. So now our next task is to plug that in over here. And so, yeah, so the algebra is mind-numbingly simple, but the consequences are really profound, so you can now, just by inspection, see what the various possibilities are for your universe when W is equal. Yeah.
With the constant omega equals 0 and omega equals 1, then how does it come about?
Sorry, am I going to explain why these guys are this?
What?
I will explain that a little bit. Can I explain that in a few minutes? Yeah, but I will get back to that. So I just want to go through the general W analysis, and let me do it in a few minutes. So what can happen here? Let's consider separately the cases k equals 0, k equals plus 1, and k equals minus 1. So in the k equals 0 case, the equation is sufficiently simple that we should just go ahead and solve it. So the fact that the left-hand side is the square of something real means it's strictly positive. So the right-hand side also has to be positive in that case. So in a flat universe, the energy density has to be positive. And so this constant, rho naught, has to be positive. But then beyond that, so we can now just take the square root of both sides, right? And so it's the square root of some constant here times a over a naught to the minus 3, 1 plus w over 2. And then we'll pull the ddt, we'll pull the dt over to this side, we'll move these factors of a over to that side, and then it's straightforward to integrate, and you find that a of t is equal to, it's just proportional, it's just a power law. 2 over 3, 1 plus w. Or, if you had done the same analysis, but in proper time, but in conformal time, the only difference would have been that instead of a dot over a, you would have written a prime over a squared here. But again, you would have just pulled the d-eta from the a prime over to this side, pulled the factors of a over there, integrated both sides, and you would have found a different constant of proportionality. I mean, a different power law for the exponent. So life is very simple in such a universe. You can either plug in t. The two possibilities are that t runs from 0 to infinity, or t runs from minus infinity to 0. And similarly, eta runs from 0 to infinity, or from minus infinity to 0. And then, depending on the value of w, which will determine whether these exponents are positive or negative, you will see whether those universes are either expanding from 0 to infinity, or whether they're contracting from infinity to 0. Okay? But so that's just, it's just as simple as can be. It just contracts as a pure power law from infinity to 0, or expands from 0 to infinity. And undoubtedly it does not need to be explained that the terminology here is that if a expands from 0, then that a equals 0 moment is called the Big Bang. And if a, man, everyone, I just somehow, imagine that everyone has heard these terms, Big Bang, Big Crunch, and that they're so embedded in the. And if you contract A equals zero, this guy is called the Big Crunch. So the only difference between the big, so these two solutions are just the time reverses of one another, and the only difference between the Big Bang and the Big Crunch, they're exactly the same geometrical thing. They're just approached. One is to your future, and one is to your past. So by comparison, let's consider the possibilities for. K equals plus 1. So if K equals plus 1, again, this side has to be greater than or equal to 0. And so the condition on rho is now, so something greater than or equal to 0 has to be equal to this energy density term, and then plus a negative number. So it's not enough for the energy density to simply be positive to satisfy this equation. It has to be greater than some positive number. So the requirement that h squared be greater than or equal to 0 means that, you know, 8 pi g rho, the first term there has to be bigger than one over a squared, because I've plugged in k equals plus one for a closed universe. So we're analyzing k equals plus one case. And so you can see that in this case, the behavior of such a universe will be different depending on whether this exponent is greater than or less than this exponent, minus 2. In other words, as the universe expands, is this term falling faster or slower than this term as A increases? So the critical value of W is when minus 3, 1 plus W is equal to minus 2. And so that's W is equal to minus 1/3, if you solve it. So if you think about it, let's say this is initially satisfied for some A, and W is greater than minus 1/3, which it is for a gas of non-relativistic matter or a gas of relativistic matter like photons. Then this guy, this exponent is more negative than minus 2. So as the universe expands, this guy falls faster than this guy until they're equal, until this inequality has become saturated, and then it can't expand anymore, right? Because that would make h squared become negative, which would be nonsense. So what it has to do is then turn around and recontract. So when W is greater than minus 1/3, this is what a closed universe does. So for a closed universe, K equals plus 1, and W greater than minus 1/3, it expands, reaches, so A, as a function of time, expands from a Big Bang, reaches a maximum A star. That's the maximum radius that the three sphere ever expands to. And then it contracts to a Big Crunch at some finite time later. Okay, so the universe has some finite age, as I say, it's still possible in principle that we live in such a universe. It's just the matter just isn't settled. So if W is less than minus 1/3 and K is equal to plus 1, then if this inequality is satisfied at some A, then as A expands, it always continues to be satisfied because this guy drops less quickly than this. But But if you look backwards in time, and A shrinks, so let's say A is expanding today, but now we look backward in time. At some point, this inequality was saturated, and that's saying that as you trace the evolution of the universe backwards, that it reaches some minimum value of A, which is different from zero. So the three spheres shrinks to some finite non-zero size, and then it can't shrink anymore without making h squared become negative, so it has to re-expand. So depending on whether, so when w is equal, is greater than minus a third, the universe expands from a big bang back to a big crunch. When w is greater than, when w is less than minus a third, it contracts to a finite size and then re-expands. It bounces at a finite radius. Okay, so then the final case is k equals minus 1. So there, the condition that h squared is strictly positive is weaker than the condition that rho be positive. So it does not require that rho be positive. So h squared greater than or equal to 0 amounts to this condition now, that the energy density need not be positive, it just needs to be bigger than some finite negative number at each value of the scale factor. And so things break into two cases here, where on the one hand, if this constant rho naught is positive, then this inequality will be satisfied for all values of A. So you won't have this phenomenon where the universe reaches a maximum and then recollapses, or reaches a minimum and then re-expands. It will just expand from zero to infinity in a way that is qualitatively just like the flat universe did. Quantitatively, it is still the case that as it expands, at early times, this term might dominate, and then at sufficiently late times, this term will dominate on the right-hand side. Or at sufficiently early times, this term will dominate, and this term will dominate at late times. Again, depending on whether W is greater than or less than this critical value, W equals minus one-third. In other words, depending on whether this exponent is greater than or less than minus 2, either this term will dominate at early times, or this term will dominate at early times, and the situation at late times will be reverse. So then there's this one final possibility, which is that rho naught is negative, but not so negative as to violate this inequality. And then if you think about it, you do run into the sort of bouncing behavior that you get, same sort of bouncing behavior that you get in a closed universe, but with the situation reversed. So in a closed universe, we found that for W greater than minus a third, the universe expanded and recollapsed, whereas for W less than minus a third, it bounced. And so if you think about it, in the case where K equals minus one, the situation is reversed. That is to say, the W greater than minus a third case is the bouncing case. The W less than minus a third case is the big bang to big crunch case. And so that was all just to say that you can read off all of the sort of possible histories, qualitatively speaking. And figure out what is the maximum size that the universe will reach, or the minimum size, just by comparing these two different terms, seeing at what value of A do they become equal to one another, and seeing which one of them scales faster as A changes. You can also, just to, And a simple exercise that I won't do, but that you'll do in tutorial, is you can also just solve it explicitly for this simple case. And check that the general explicit solution behaves in the way that you think it should. So the general simple explicit solution is, it really turns out to be perfectly nice. So I'll just briefly comment on it. It's an exercise worth going through to see that this is what it is. Just to assure yourself that you understand how those equations get solved and how the solution corresponds to your qualitative expectation. But so S sub k here is the function that it's the same function that we had defined before when we were switching from the radial coordinate r to the other radial coordinate chi. We defined this function S sub k of chi, which was sine chi when k was equal to plus 1, sinh chi when k is equal to minus 1, and chi when k is equal to 0. So this is that function raised to the alphath power. So if and then this is just some constant, and this is some constant. So a of eta has this rather simple form that is just this. It's this function s sub k, depending on whether k is equal to plus 1, 0, 1, or plus 1, minus 1, or 0, raised to the power alpha, where alpha is just a constant, 2 over 1 plus 3 w. And so you can check that, for example, in the k equals 0 case, where s sub k just reduces to k, this is just eta to the alpha. And we'd already said that by solving directly in the k equals 0 case that we got eta to the alpha. Okay? I think that in the interest of brevity, that was sort of all I wanted to say. That is really just a teaser of the general possibilities for how the universe can evolve. But I mean, yeah, it captures basically everything essentially qualitatively different that can happen. Another thing that I was just going to mention is that you may ask a question that could come up. Is that I have been always assuming that the universe stops or ends when A is equal to 0. But you might ask, you know, how do I know that's so it looks like the metric becomes singular at that point. It looks like various components of the metric, diagonal components of the metric, go to 0. But how do I know, the same thing happens in the Schwarzschild metric at the horizon. But famously, that is not a real singularity. That's just a coordinate singularity. Or in polar coordinates at the origin, you know, one of the components of the metric is r squared d phi squared, and that component of the metric goes to 0 at r equals 0. But there's nothing singular about r equals 0 in polar coordinates. All that singularity is coming from your choice of coordinates. How do you know that the same is not true here? So another exercise in the tutorial, simple exercise, is just to plug this guy in and see that at the value, use this in the first lecture, and in the problem sets, you calculated a simple expression for the Ricci scalar of an FRW spacetime, and it's some simple function of A double dot over A, and it's proportional to something times A double dot over A plus something times A dot over A squared, and then maybe there's a K over A, something times K over A squared. But this thing is independent of coordinates, and if you plug in these solutions, you will find that generically this guy does diverge at the same, the curvature, the actual physical curvature, that's something independent of coordinates, diverges at the point where a goes to zero, at the value of chi where a goes to zero. Except in some special cases, you may notice that in some special cases that doesn't happen, and that could be interesting to think about also. There are a few special cases where what looks like an ordinary FRW universe is actually some simpler non-singular spacetime expressed in weird coordinates. But that's some weird special case. But the main point is just to see one time that in the generic case, apart from those special cases, that A equals zero really is curvature singularity. So the universe, at least according to classical laws, the space-time manifold could not have continued back past that. And then there's this famous result due to the whole point of this, you might ask instead, well, our universe isn't a perfect FRW universe. It's not perfectly homogeneous and isotropic. I mean, we see, you know, for example, the universe today is quite inhomogeneous. Could it be that this singularity, just like people had originally asked with the FRW, with the black hole metric, they had said, okay, the Schwarzschild metric has a singularity at the center, but that's not physical. That's just a remnant of this overly idealized situation you're thinking about, a perfectly static, spherically symmetric star. And similarly, people, a lot of theoretical cosmology a few decades ago was about whether the same objection applied here, that it looked like there was a curvature singularity at the beginning of an FRW universe when A was equal to zero, but maybe that was just an artifact of taking an extremely idealized special metric, and maybe if you added perturbations and followed those back, that they would wiggle around in such a way as to avoid becoming singular. The sort of first, so Penrose, and then so something that I can't cover in this class, but is one of the sort of great triumphs of classical general relativity, were these techniques invented by Penrose and then sort of brought to fruition by these two guys in collaboration, showed that in both the black hole case and in the cosmological case, that was not what happened. That under a certain set of rather reasonable and rigorous assumptions, and under the assumptions that classical general relativity was correct, that in fact the black hole center of the Schwarzschild metric was an actual physical thing. It was to be expected that you would form a singularity like that when a realistic star collapsed, let's say. And similarly, that the singularity at the start of the Big Bang universe was a real physical thing. That if the universe obeyed classical laws all the way back, that a singularity had to be expected under rather general circumstances. Now, of course, that's a big if. It may still be the case that as you get very close to the center of a black hole, that you know the out is that classical general relativity is no longer valid, or as you get very close to the Big Bang, classical general relativity is no longer valid, and so you escape the singularity that way. So anyway, that's possible. Let's see. The one other thing I wanted to say is that Briefly, we've talked about the evolution of a universe with just a single matter component with a constant equation of state. Is it time for a joke? Probably yes. So now I have to even remember, what was I going to say? Oh yeah. So for this joke, by the way, since I don't trust my pronunciation, this joke will involve the term shod. So this is to put a shoe on something. So like a horse can be shod, that means you take the horse and you put a horseshoe on its foot. Okay. So just to avoid any miscommunication to people who don't speak Old English. So a rabbit is running through the forest and he runs into the wolf. He's panting, he's afraid. And the wolf says, "What's the matter?" And the rabbit says, "They're rounding up the camels, and they're being shod." And he says, "But you're not a camel. Why are you worried?" And he says, "Well, just after you get rounded up and shod, you try to explain to them you're not a camel." Anyway. It's interesting to see which ones are actually. I would say this was not the most successful one, but I kind of have my eye on all of you, and I'm curious about which jokes you do and don't laugh at. But, okay. Oh, sorry. Oh. So our actual universe does not have just a single matter component. Once upon a time, let's say a long, long time ago, and maybe like 1975 or something like that, people thought that the universe had basically just, to a very good approximation, just had two components. It had a matter component with this equation of state, which I know I still haven't gotten back to explaining. But so it had a matter component. It was one component was a dust of non-relativistic matter. So its energy density scaled as a to the minus 3. And then the other component was a gas of relativistic matter, radiation. So non-relativistic matter, for some reason, cosmologists just call that matter. And relativistic matter, a gas of relativistic particles, they call that radiation. So they thought that the matter content of the universe was like this. So if you plug this in to this equation, So according to this equation, if you look at the term that scales the fastest with A, the term that scales as the most negative power of A, it's this radiation term. So this says that if I take A to be sufficiently small, if I look sufficiently far in the past, according to this equation, the universe should have been dominated by radiation. The whole right-hand side should have been almost given by this term with these terms negligible. And then eventually, if I wait long enough, as A increases, this term becomes smaller than this term. Okay, so far so good, because there were good observational reasons to believe, even back then, and so we will explain more later. That the early universe was dominated by radiation, and that there came a point when the universe was about 1,000 times smaller, when A was about 1,000 times smaller, or between 1,000 and 10,000 times smaller than it was today, than it is today. So everything was closer together linearly by a factor of between 1,000 and 10,000. That our universe did make a transition from being dominated by radiation to being dominated by matter. So far, so good. But there was this puzzle that if you looked at sufficiently late times, this equation predicts that unless K is somehow magically set to zero, and there's no known law of physics that does that, then at sufficiently late times, this term should dominate. And so the question was, you know, and yet, even in the 1970s, they knew that this term couldn't be bigger than this term at the present time. So the question is, you know, what it seems naively that relative to all other scales you can think of in physics, certainly any fundamental fundamental time scales of microscopic physics, that today is exceptionally late. You know, 10 billion years is some exceptionally long time relative to any other fundamental scale in physics. So why is it that this term is still so small? What tuned this term to be so small, or what set k equal either to zero or to approximately zero? So anyway, as I was explaining yesterday, that's the flatness puzzle. And again, the inflationary solution was to say that at some early time, there was another component in this equation, rho inflation, with an equation of state greater than this critical value of minus a third. So it's scaled as some power of a that was slower than this. So at early times, the expansion went along, and this term came to completely dominate over any of these other three terms that might have been present, so that they became utterly negligible. And then, at some point, something ended that period, and so that's called so at some point the universe quote unquote reheated, and this energy density got converted by some process, and there are candidate physical processes for this which are actually more plausible than that process might sound to you if, by the way, I just described it. When we discuss inflation, we will talk about this more. But so the basic idea is that at some point, after this guy has achieved thorough domination over all of these other terms, it converts itself into matter and radiation. Whatever energy density was supplying, was driving inflation, converts itself into matter and radiation. And so now you suddenly, this amount of energy density gets split into two terms like this, which then go about their business. So you then have a universe with this guy remains negligible. But these guys are now not negligible because, although the previous incarnations of these terms were rendered negligible by this, the decay of this produced more of these guys. So the rest of the universe would look like just the evolution of these two terms with no term like this, which was what you wanted in order to solve the flatness problem. And then the final thing to say is that just as with the horizon problem, another thing that was observed just within the past 10 to 15 years was that there appears to be, in order to fit a variety of observations, you appear to have to add another term. There's still no evidence for this term, but you do appear to have to add another term that appears to scale as a to the zero. So in other words, or approximately a to the zero. It appears to be roughly a constant term that doesn't vary with a. And in our in terms of this formula, rho goes as a to the minus 3, 1 plus w. That means w is equal to minus 1 if you want this exponent to be zero. And so that's why it appears that the universe today is either has some component of vacuum energy in it, or something approximately that behaves like vacuum energy, or we just don't understand, or general relativity is wrong, or who knows what. I mean, yeah. So this is the standard and simplest modification of the Friedman equations that can account for the observations. What the actual meaning of these observations continues to be unresolved. Okay. So now that, yeah, so with that said, I'm going to now go on to the other notes. Can I erase all this? Sorry. Consider that like another played a role analogous to the Russian jokes. That's more like me just turning around and saying, So, if you have any conserved quantity, if you have any conserved quantity Q, so that quantity doesn't change with time, and now let's say it's spread out through an expanding FRW universe. So it's the spatial integral of some density. So this might be the electric charge, or this might be the total number of protons in the universe, or who knows what. But in a region where this number is conserved, doesn't change with time, the density is the total number divided by the volume. But the physical volume, so let's say the density, you might pick out some box, some co-moving, let's say, I always imagine that this is going to be easier to visualize on the sphere. But so you draw some little box on the surface of the balloon that you're living on, and then you blow up the balloon, and the total amount of charge, Q, in that balloon stays fixed. But as you blow up the balloon, I've drawn it as a two-dimensional patch, but really we're talking about a universe with three spatial dimensions, so it's some three-dimensional patch. As you blow up the balloon, the lines stay drawn on the balloon, but the volume that they contain goes up as you blow up the balloon, and the radius of the balloon increases, as A increases, the volume contained inside your patch goes up as the number of dimensions of the patch, A to the number of dimensions, so spatial dimensions. So the volume increases proportional to A cubed while Q stays fixed. So any conserved quantity, its density drops as A cubed, as the universe expands. So in particular, if you have some species of particle whose total number is conserved, then their number density, their physical number density, the number of those particles per physical volume, per unit physical volume, also drops as A cubed. And so the energy density associated with those particles, well, the energy density is just computed by, for each particle, multiplying by the energy of that particle. So the energy density of that species will drop as E over A cubed. But E is the mass of that particle plus its momentum squared. And we said that the momentum, we learned in a previous lecture that the magnitude of the momentum drops as 1 over A. So if you have a very non-relativistic particle, by which I mean a particle whose spatial momentum is negligible relative to mc squared. So you are an example of such a particle. Then E basically has no A dependence. M is just a constant, right? M is just the mass. The only A dependence is in P. So if P is negligible, then E is independent of A. And so for non-relativistic matter, we find that that rho goes as A to the minus 3. On the other hand, for highly relativistic matter, like a photon for which M is 0, or just another particle that's moving so fast that its momentum, this term is huge, relative to mc squared, which this is a lot of particles we'll see are like this in the, basically everything becomes like this if you look sufficiently early in the history of the universe. For such particles, E is just proportional to P squared. I mean, E is proportional to P, which is proportional to 1 over A. So for highly relativistic particles, i.e. radiation, their energy density goes down as A to the minus 4. But then we saw that We also saw from the continuity equation that if we define p, oh sorry, this is momentum p, and this is pressure p. If we define the pressure, if the pressure is a constant times the energy density, then A goes as minus 3, 1 plus W, we saw by solving the continuity equation. And so this is the easiest way to see the thing that you were asking about, that for a gas of non-relativistic matter, for minus 4 to be equal to minus 3, 1 plus W, W has to be 1 third. Whereas for minus 3 to be equal to minus 3, 1 plus W has to be 0. Okay, that's the simplest way to derive the equation of state for relativistic and non-relativistic matter. Okay. So now, we're not as behind as it looks because the thing that I will cover next time. There's really two key things that we need to know to then proceed with questions about dark matter and baryogenesis. And that is, so these very simple arguments, these are very important. These are good things to remember. But this is how matter behaves in an expanding universe when the number of particles is conserved, or some other quantity associated with the matter is conserved. So another very important case to understand is where the particles are in thermal equilibrium. So they have a distribution function. So each species of particle has a distribution function, which is either the Bose-Einstein distribution function, if it is a boson, or the Fermi-Dirac distribution function, if it's a fermion. So what we want to know is when a particle like that is in thermal equilibrium at some temperature T and with some chemical potential mu I. So now, as the universe expands, we will see that T drops basically as 1 upon A. So the thermal bath is cooling, and for a given species in contact with that thermal bath with a chemical potential mu I, we want to know how it evolves with time. What happens to it as the universe cools? And in particular, what happens to it when it is massless versus when it is massive? So yeah, you might say that two of the, if you want to sort of condense what you should be remembering from this course, about the behavior of matter in the universe, there was this fact about particles moving along geodesics. In other words, particles that are just freely moving through the space-time, not scattering off of anything. How do they behave? They behave. Their momentum, their spatial momentum redshifts is 1 upon A, and we said that means one thing for massless particles and another thing for massive particles. And so then this is the other equally important thing to understand is, whereas these were freely moving particles that were just moving through the space-time on geodesics, not colliding with anything, these are particles in thermal equilibrium. They're colliding like crazy with their neighbors, so much so that they've achieved statistical equilibrium. And again, for these guys, we want to know, in that other sort of simple limiting circumstance, how do the massless guys evolve and how do the massive guys evolve? And so I'll cover that tomorrow. We'll see. I don't think that'll take the whole lecture. But then we'll be able to move on to an explanation of sort of the two most crucial observations of the early universe, the cosmic microwave background and the Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Again, the idea is to have each of those only take half a lecture. And then after that, we'll do dark matter, baryogenesis, and dark energy. Hopefully those will fit into the end of this week.